William versus People case. May I have the entry of your appearance, please, on behalf of Mr. Dean?
Allison Rutherford, 17497, ADC Attorney Counsel for Mr. Dean.
Thank you, Ms. Rutherford. Before the people, please, Mr. Cronin. All right, counsel, this is set for 1 hour. You both know the drill. If you wish to save any time, Ms. Rutherford, you'll need to do so yourself and then we'll just count down. So whenever you're ready, please, if you'll go ahead.
Good morning. I'm here on behalf of Mr. Dean, who was convicted in Denver County Court of second-degree murder after being charged with first-degree murder. He was found to be an habitual criminal. However, none of his prior convictions were crimes of violence. So he was sentenced as an habitual offender under CRS 18-1.3-80, subsection 2, rather than subsection 1. And pursuant to the subsection 2, the maximum in the presumptive range in 24 years for a second class felony was quadrupled to 96 years. In combination with the parole statute, which is CRS 17-22.5-405, subsections 1 and 4, what this means is that Mr. Dean has an effective life without possibility of parole, because his sentence is 96 years with parole eligibility at 72 years. And under the life expectancy tables, if you look at the census table, which is referred to now in Colorado statutes, the life expectancy for any adult is 72 years and under, and especially when you've got an incarcerated black male, no adult incarcerated black male is going to be expected to live longer than 72 years. So Mr. Dean, in effect, has a life sentence without the possibility of parole. However, had he had a prior crimes of violence rather than nonviolent crimes, then he would have been mandatorily sentenced under subsection 1 of the habitual offender statute. And that statute provides that the mandatory sentence for a second class felony is life, but with parole after 40 years. So ironically, Mr. Dean is being punished now for not having prior violent felony convictions because he has prior nonviolent felony convictions. His sentence is now effectively twice as long had he had prior violent felony convictions. So you compare life with parole after 40 with life, an effective life sentence with parole after 72, and I have been advancing this equal protection argument on his behalf ever since. I can find or not think of any possible rational reason for how this statutory scheme advances any legitimate interest of the state. I think it's pretty clear that the General Assembly didn't think of this possibility, and you know, when you look at these statutes in combination, it's just not something that was considered. It's irrational to punish an offender who has nonviolent felonies by giving him an effective life without possibility of parole, whereas if he had two prior violent felony third class convictions, then he would have mandatorily been given the possibility of parole after 40 years, which theoretically would make him parole eligible in his lifetime.
Now, doesn't your argument really say that any sentence whatsoever, regardless of what the General Assembly provides, it wants this provision of a 40-year parole, doesn't that basically supersede everything else? Because a lot of these sentences look like they go beyond a person's lifetime. I mean, is it just a black male here in this particular circumstance? I mean, aren't you arguing that the whole sentencing scheme is basically disproportionate?
Yes, I mean, it would be just as disproportionate if we had a white female who was the defendant, but particularly with a black male, I mean, they've got the lowest life expectancy of any.
Well, I'm just wondering if you want us to displace all the General Assembly's sentencing schemes here.
Not the entire sentencing scheme. I'm only asking for something very narrow. I'm saying that the only portion of CRS 18-1.3-801 that is unconstitutional is sentencing of offenders who were convicted of a second-class violent felony, not a second-class nonviolent felony, such as COCA. There's some COCA convictions that are nonviolent, but offenders who have a violent second-class felony conviction for which they're being sentenced as an unhabitual offender and have all or at least less than two nonviolent prior third-class felony convictions. So that's a very narrow class of people. It's only those convicted of second-class violent felony convictions, you know, kidnapping and second-degree murder, who have all nonviolent prior felony convictions. And there's a couple people in the same situation as Mr. Dean whose appeals are circulating up through the system, but that's a very narrow class of people. And, you know, I think one of the reasons why this kind of illogical result happened is because that is such a narrow class of people, and it just really wasn't considered that when you look at the two statutes in conjunction, that you would get this very illogical result. I would also like to take a few minutes to talk about the Alexander case, 797 P. 2nd 1250, which is the case that the people are relying on. The people contend that in this case, the Colorado Supreme Court has, you know, previously looked at this exact issue and rejected it, but I respectfully submit that the facts in the Alexander case are dramatically different. That was a prior version of the habitual offender statute. In that statute, what was being compared was kind of what we call the little bitch versus the big bitch, and the old big bitch was life withdrawal after 20 years, and then the little bitch, or the lesser, was a mandatory sentence between 20 and 50 years. So Mr. Alexander was arguing, since he was sentenced to 25 years as an habitual offender, that effectively gave him a longer sentence than if he had had more violent or more priors, and then he would have been given life with parole after 20. And parole eligibility at 20 years is different than his parole eligibility at 23 years had he with his 25-year sentence. What's so different about the Alexander case is we're not comparing two different life sentences. In the Dean case, we're comparing two different life sentences: life with parole after 40, and then this effective life without the possibility of parole, which is what, 96 years with parole eligibility after 72 years effectively is. Mr. Alexander did not get a life sentence, and his parole eligibility date was arguably only 3 years longer than had he been given the life sentence. That is not a big difference. That is not something that's irrational. And I don't think it's even correct that he wouldn't have been parole eligible until he reached 23 years. If you look at the title for the Article 22, Title 17 statutes that were in effect at the time the Alexander case was decided, Mr. Alexander was parole eligible after he spent 10 or 12 years in the DOC with earned time. So he always had a lower sentence than any potential counterpart with the life after 20. So I think trying to compare the Alexander case to what happened to Mr. Dean is apples and oranges. That's, you cannot use the conclusion reached in Alexander that there was no equal protection violation and apply it in this case. You know, in the Alexander case, there were rational reasons why the legislature might want somebody like Mr. Alexander, who had a determinate sentence, who absolutely did not have a life sentence, to have his freedom be based solely at the discretion of the parole board, and then give somebody with a life sentence with parole eligibility after 20 years who could conceivably get parole after 20, but nobody gets parole when they're first eligible, and typically people who are habitual offenders, the first time they meet the parole board, they're set back for 3 years. So actually, Mr. Alexander was in exactly the same position as the counterpart he was trying to argue with life at 20.
Could I ask for a clarification on that? Would it be fair to say then you agree that this argument has been disposed of by us, except in the situation in which there are competing life sentences?
Well, I don't think this argument has been disposed of by this court where there are competing life sentences. I don't think that this court's decision in the Alexander case is similar enough to what happened with this new habitual offender statute, with this 96-year effective life sentence. If you can say that the court has disposed of this equal protection argument, the situation in the Alexander case is just way too different than what happened in this case.
I think I probably didn't ask my question well enough, or maybe I'm not understanding your answer, but so does it come down then to, you're saying Alexander has not disposed of this case for the reason that you in effect have two life sentences?
Yes.
But were it not for that, Alexander would have disposed of this equal protection argument.
Right. The Alexander case disposed of all these other equal protection.
And so if it were just a situation in which one sentenced under the statutes that your client was, I don't care if he's 19 years old and he only got 40 years in a day, you wouldn't be making the same.
No.
Okay.
No. I mean, what's critical in this case is we have two life sentences we're comparing, and irrationally, the guy with the better record, with the nonviolent record, is now has to spend twice as long in prison before he sees the parole board than his counterpart with a very violent record, who has not only been convicted of a violent second-class felony, but has two or more prior violent second and third class felony convictions. That's a very violent individual that we usually don't see getting sentenced. And he gets a much, arguably a much lighter sentence, a much more favorable sentence than Mr. Dean got, because Mr. Dean has all nonviolent priors and therefore got the mandatory 96 with parole eligibility after 72 years. And I think also the Attorney General is trying to argue that, well, all that matters is the maximum potential sentence, but that can't be true, because otherwise you could never have an equal protection argument in these sentences regarding life sentences, and that simply is not correct. In this case, there's no chance for the parole board to even exercise its discretion with respect to Mr. Dean. There's no chance that Mr. Dean is ever going to meet the parole board anytime in his natural life. If he has to wait for 72 years, the way that statute is worded, he cannot even reduce that 72 years with earned time and good time, because he can only reduce his maximum sentence, which is 96 years, by 25%. And I don't think the 2012 amendments to that statute do anything to change that. He still has an effective life sentence with parole eligibility at the point that's well past his natural lifetime expectancy. And even if he was a much younger man when he was sentenced, if he was in his 20s rather than his 50s, we would still have this equal protection issue, except it'd be all the more critical because a much younger man could possibly get paroled with a sentence with life after 40. That has happened, and it does happen, and it conceivably can happen that the parole board would parole somebody with a life with parole eligibility after 40. I think, but in Mr. Dean's case, because he has a completely nonviolent prior record, he has no chance at all to see the parole board, and he received an effective life without possibility of parole, which is the same sentence he would have received had he been convicted of the first degree murder. If there's no further questions from the court at this time, I'd like to reserve the rest of my
time. Actually, sorry, before this case, I'm curious, what would your proposed remedy be in this situation? What would we do if we agree with you? What happens is,
well, in this case, what would happen then is all the offenders who fall within this very narrow class, who have been convicted of a violent second-class felony, have had their sentences quadrupled pursuant to Section 2 of the Habitual Offender Act, they could not be sentenced as habitual offenders because the Habitual Offender Act is unconstitutional as applied to them. So they would have to, their cases would have to be remanded for resentencing to somewhere in the presumptive range, which in this case, because it's a violent second-class felony, is anywhere up to 48 years. So he could still receive a 48-year sentence, and probably would receive a 48-year sentence, but then he'd be parole eligible pursuant to Article 22 of Title 17, somewhere after serving between 20 and 24 years. So the remedy would be resentencing without regard to the unconstitutional habitual offender statute, because it cannot be constitutionally applied to this very narrow class of offenders who've been convicted of violent F2 felonies.
So I guess I'm curious about that, because it seems to me that the crux of your argument is not the length of the sentence, but rather the parole eligibility date that's tethered to that lengthier sentence, right?
Right.
And yet the remedy you're proposing would be to actually reduce the sentence itself. So isn't really the concern here about the point at which he's parole eligible, not the length of the sentence? You're not challenging the length of the sentence.
Well, I mean, I suppose I don't think this court can rewrite the habitual offender statute. Only the general legislature could do that. And I'm sure if I win this case, the general legislature will very quickly amend the statute next session. But the only remedy available to this court without rewriting the statute is to just order that the habitual offender statute cannot be applied, constitutionally applied in the situation. Therefore, there's nothing else this court can do except to remand for resentencing under just the main sentencing statute without regard to the habitual offender statute, because otherwise the court would have to rewrite the habitual offender statute and order that this very narrow class of offenders that have been that fall under the subsection 2 could then be sentenced under subsection 1, and this court can't achieve that without actually rewriting the statute, which only the General Assembly.
And that's a very fair point. So I guess my next question would be, in your mind, what would be the legislative resolution of this? Would it be a situation where, no matter how these folks are sentenced, the farthest out of eligibility date would be 4 years?
I think the easiest way for the general legislature to put the fix in is to put some language in subsection 1 of the habitual offender statute to say that would control if sentencing under subsection 2 or subsection 2.5 would create a longer sentence, a longer effective sentence, in conjunction with Article 22 of Title 17, rather than it have, say, that mandatorily this category of offenders goes under subsection 1, mandatorily this category of offenders goes under subsection 2, for then the sentencing court to then have the discretion to sentence under subsection 1 if that produces parole eligibility sooner.
Thank you.
Was he only convicted of the one substantive count?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes, he was only sentenced on the one count of second degree murder. There were no other charges. If there's no other questions, I'd like to reserve my time. Thank you.
Let me just, Mr. Clement.
May it please the court. Indeed, for the court to rule in the defendant's favor, it would have to declare this sentencing scheme irrational beyond a reasonable doubt. And it's based, of course, on this equal protection idea that you can't sentence one person more harshly for less serious prior offenses. The defendant here in this murder conviction has 5 prior felonies he was found guilty of, and he argues that if 2 of them had been more serious, he would have been parole eligible earlier. I want to make, I guess, 3 main points that I think are important to understand. First of all, it's just the standard of review. We're looking at rational basis review. Our question is simply whether, well, we presume the statute constitutional, first of all. And our question is only whether or not there's some reasonable basis for the legislature to have created the legislative scheme that it did. The question is not whether it's the correct result, whether it's the best way, whether it could have been done better. It's not whether it's ironic or sometimes anomalous. We're just looking, is there a reasonable basis for the legislature to set up sentencing the way it did here? And the reason there is it first of all makes sense for the legislature to impose percentages of sentences, generally speaking, as for parole eligibility. You can't do that for life sentences, so the legislature can rationally say, we still do want to extend parole eligibility, but what we're going to do is say, after this very lengthy amount of time, that's where we'll set it. There's no other way to do it, and the legislature can rationally say, for this certain type of offense and classification of prior offenses, we're going to impose a life sentence, a maximum possibility of life. The second important point, I think, is eligibility for parole is not the same thing as parole. And that kind of goes back to what this court said in Alexander, which is, it's rational for the legislature to say, after some given period of time, we place the decision into the hands of the parole board. We can rely on the parole board to thereafter make reasonable determinations on a case-by-case basis, based on, you know, not only the maximum possible sentence, but each offender, you know, that as well as all the other factors that go into parole decisions. And what this court said in Black is, even parolees are still subject to the supervision of the Department of Corrections, and they're subject to re-imprisonment for the entire period of their sentence. So that's the reason the focus is the maximum possible prison sentence and not just parole eligibility. Even a parolee is subject to the DOC's supervision and is subject to re-imprisonment for the entire period of the sentence. Alexander is almost exactly like this case. I think it's controlling here. The only point I've heard mentioned now is that the 50-year, if I understand correctly, that the 50-year sentence, maximum sentence that Mr. Alexander was subject to is not the same as the 96-year sentence. Defendant concedes, first of all, it is the same thing in his case because he was 50 years old at the time of sentencing and said, and admits he won't reach parole eligibility either way. And I'll say that flippantly, just that's his admission in the case. I disagree with the assertion that he would have been parole eligible, I'm sorry, Mr. Alexander would have been parole eligible after 12 years. This court specifically said in Alexander, parole eligibility was at 23 years. And so it presented the same problem here, a 50-year sentence with 23 years for parole eligibility, or a life sentence with 20 years until parole eligibility. And Mr. Alexander had more serious prior, I think it was more prior offenses in that case, he would have received a life sentence with a 20-year parole eligibility. So it's the exact same thing we're confronted with in this case, the only difference being the length of the parole eligibility and sentences that have been imposed. And I'll say this court, the reasoning this court relied on is what I mentioned in Alexander. It didn't mention anything about the difference between a 50-year sentence and a life sentence. It said it's rational because the legislature can say after some period of time, we can give this to the parole board and trust that the parole board will make reasonable decisions in each case. With respect to the remedy, I'll just address it briefly because Justice Marquez brought it up. I think the remedy, looking at this court's decision in Nguyen and Smith, and Nguyen contains a great discussion of proper remedy. It would seem to me that, I mean, you certainly can't sentence Mr. Dean under the life sentence with parole eligibility after 4 years. He doesn't qualify for that sentence under the statute. I don't think you could import a 40-year parole eligibility requirement just into this other statute, the general parole eligibility statute, because that portion of that is a very specific statute, individual criminal sentencing statutes, and it's just nowhere contemplated in the parole eligibility statutes. It's his suggestion that you would just not sentencing at all under individual criminal sentencing and therefore reduce the sentence to 48 years instead of 96 as a maximum, and that would be then placing it in the hands of the judge, of course, instead of the mandatory quadrupling that he received. To me, that seems, and I think the point was we're kind of killing a fly with a hammer. I mean, his only issue is parole eligibility. It's not the length of the sentence. He concedes. And the legislature's intent was he would receive a very lengthy sentence because he had five prior felonies and he was convicted of second-degree murder. The only remedy I can see is to then say, we won't apply the 75% rule, and he would be subject to the ordinary parole eligibility requirements. That's the only thing I see in the statutes that could be done, and I'm basing that on the fact that in Nguyen, what this court said was the disparity created in Nguyen was created by application of the crime of violence statute, which required, you know, from midpoint to the max, twice the maximum presumptive range. And if we eliminated that, the two crimes at issue there would have been subject to the same penalties rather than having one of them multiplied. So here, it seems like, and this court would, of course, look to the statute, I think it's Title 2, 2-4, 201, like it was discussed in Nguyen, that the legislature set forth the principles that it prefers to be applied if the statute is determined to be unconstitutional. But it seems to me that the way to stay most faithful to the sentence the legislature intended for Mr. Dean would be to say, not that we now have his sentence and just don't apply habitual criminal sentencing at all, but he gets the ordinary sort of parole eligibility application rather than saying that, you know, he can never go below 75%. But in any case, the reasoning of Alexander and Black and the fact that we're applying rational basis review, I think, counts us against saying that this is, you know, an irrational scheme beyond a reasonable doubt, and I don't think the defendant has established that. And if the court doesn't have any questions, I'll be happy to.
Just to make sure I understand the crux of your argument,
yes.
It's rational in the sense in that it's rational just as a general matter to tether parole eligibility as a percentage of the overall sentence. And in the specific case of a life sentence, we have to pick
right.
Essentially an arbitrary date, and the legislature has chosen 40, and that is also a rational choice.
Yes.
And in that sense, the scheme overall is rational.
Yes, that's our position.
Thank you.
And so, Mr. Crane, I don't hear you to be making any argument predicated on the notion that we need to change Colorado law to be coextensive with federal law in this area. Am I right about that?
In what sense, Your Honor?
Well, to the extent that there's a difference under Batchelder and cases of that sort, you're not asking us to go there.
My understanding of this principle, and I think it's what the Court of Appeals said also, but I agree in the sense that the Court of Appeals point out, and I think it's correct, the equal protection principle at issue here isn't based on similarly situated individuals. And so that the specific Colorado equal protection principle that's at issue in Batchelder and Calabresi, I think, was first announced. I don't think that's actually the principle that's in play here. In Black, what this court said was, well, these individuals aren't similarly situated, but it then went on to apply this other principle saying otherwise rational basis review applies. And so my understanding of the equal protection principle at issue here is that it's not that same principle, it's this other thing where we're not looking at identical conduct, we're looking at imposing different, a more harsh penalty for less serious conduct, and that's what this court discussed in Nguyen and Smith, where you had this kind of strange thing where if you committed a more serious crime, you got a lesser sentence. It was under the secondary assault statutes. Thank you.
Sure.
So if there's no further questions, I'll ask the court affirm.
Thank you. For this time.
Well, just so it's clear, I'm not arguing that this is an ironic result. I am arguing that this is irrational beyond a reasonable doubt. The statutory scheme is irrational as applied to this very limited class of offenders, the F2 offenders with less than two prior convictions of crimes of violence. It is irrational to punish Mr. Dean because he has a nonviolent criminal past rather than a violent criminal past. And I still haven't heard any reasonable basis for the General Assembly to have created this irrational result. The people claim that, well, it's rational and reasonable to rely on the parole board to make reasonable determinations, and therefore for the General Assembly to say, well, after you serve a certain percentage of your sentence, then it's up to the parole board. But that cannot happen here. There is no way that Mr. Dean is ever going to see the parole board. 72 years is beyond the life expectancy of any human being, pursuant to this U.S. Census Bureau mortality tables, except for 6 and 9 year olds, and 6 and 9 year olds are not tried as adults. So nobody with a parole eligibility date after 72 years is ever going to see the parole board. Mr. Dean is never going to see the parole board, unlike his counterpart with violent priors who will see the parole board after 40 years. And that is reasonable that with some offenders, they will be able to see the parole board within 40 years, as opposed to giving a parole eligibility date that per se, based on the life expectancy tables, is beyond the life expectancy of any adult offender, especially somebody who is going to be old enough that they're going to be an habitual offender and have more than one felony conviction. So,
Ms. Gunnberg?
Sure.
Over here, I'm sorry. So what's your response to Mr. Craig's suggestion about a possible remedy under Nguyen dealing with parole eligibility date, using a regular date rather than the 75% rule?
I still don't see how the court can reach this result without rewriting a statute, except this time you're going to be rewriting Article 22.5 of Title 17 by grafting onto that some sort of provision that this narrow category of offenders that is accepted from the 75% rule. The General Assembly can certainly do that, and that could be one of the potential fixes here. Another fix,
but not if your client without being expected, right?
So exactly.
Doesn't your client end up reaping kind of windfall that doesn't really seem to capture the legislative intent for someone with five priors? And help me with that, right?
Well, arguably my client would reap a windfall because just like the offenders on death row who then could not be sentenced to death when the death row statute became unconstitutional and then couldn't be reapplied to them ex post facto. That's the consequence of having an unconstitutional statute. There's going to be a couple offenders who aren't going to reap the benefit. Mr. Dean is one of them. I know of at least one other person in exactly the same situation who is making the same equal protection arguments, and there might be a couple of more, which is why I'm assuming that the General Assembly will come in very quickly and fix this so that there are not more. But I don't see any way to fix this without rewriting the statutes or committing some other type of constitutional violation under the ex post facto clause. The only solution here is that the habitual offender statute, because it's unconstitutional, cannot be applied to Mr. Dean. Because there's no way to apply subsection 1 of the habitual offender statute, for example, without rewriting that statute. I think another legislative fix, and I didn't articulate that very well the first time I was up here, is to simply state that if offenders that normally fell under subsection 2 or subsection 2.5 have a parole eligibility date in excess of 40 years, then they would fall under subsection 1. Or the court would have that discretion to sentence them under subsection 1 so that the statute is rational and reasonable and doesn't violate equal protection. And so again, I'm urging the court to overturn the Court of Appeals and find the habitual offender statute unconstitutional as applied to this very narrow class of offenders and remand for resentencing under the presumptive sentencing statute, since the habitual offender statute cannot be constitutionally applied to Mr. Dean. Thank you.
Thank you very much. We appreciate your argument, Ms. Rittenberg, and we appreciate your argument, Mr. Crane. I don't know whether we're ready to go on to the next case or not. Lock up now.
Take a break.
We'll be in recess then in about 10 minutes. Whenever they're ready to go, let us know.